Hello and welcome to the Pod of the Damned. I'm your host, Ian, and joining me this week is not my regular co-host, Nico, but a very special co-host. Please welcome Jeff Newman from the Movies for Days podcast onto the show. Jeff, how's it going, my friend?
Fantastic, Ian. Thank you so much for having me on to talk about this flick. It's been a long time coming.
I've been a big fan of your guys' show
for a while.
It feels like a very long time since I'd appeared on your show as well. That feels like such a long time ago, and we had such a blast. I had so much fun talking about Hatchet with you. It was a really great episode. I was really happy. Like, I was really proud of like sort of the work we did with that one.
Yeah, same, man. You're welcome back anytime. That was a great episode. And yeah, so glad to be here. I know that I'm a lot more positive than Nico tends to be. I'll try to fill his shoes. I'm currently naked and there is a cat. It's not mine, but I've got it. And I'm just going to be a real sour cunt about everything today. Just, I want you to feel comfortable.
That's absolutely fine. You know, being a Scottish podcast, it comes second nature to us. It's just, you know, it's just a property of our people. You know, we're just really miserable people. It's fine. It's absolutely fine. You said no, replacing Nico in his sourness, but Nico's probably, you know, and when we look at the scores, Nico's a more generous scorer than I am when it comes to, you know, reviewing these movies. You know, we keep track of these things, and I'm having a look over like the leaderboard. Nico scores movies more points. We've scored about the same amount of points across the movies, but Nico's not scored about three or four of the movies that we've reviewed because of, you know, other commitments. He's not been able to be on every episode, so he's scoring points left, right, and center way more than I am. So, you know, I think
a man who
he's a man who likes what he likes.
He's a man who loves to laugh.
Yeah.
You know, he loves to laugh, and I'll give him that too. He's got it. He's got some joy in his heart.
He is, but I'm not gonna lie. And Nico, I hope you're listening. I do kind of enjoy it when he's not here for an episode or two.
Absence makes the heart grow fonder, and absinthe even more so.
Yes,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah, man. Fucking it, man. Glad to be here. This is going to be a good one.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we'll give you an opportunity to do your plugs and tell everyone a little bit about your show in just a couple of seconds. Before I do that, just remind everyone that we are a horror podcast that deep dives into a different topic every single week in our quest to create a leaderboard of the best and worst horror movies of all time. This is episode number 103. After all those weeks and months of finally saying, oh, you know, episode 100 is coming up. It's so good to finally be in the triple figure camp. So this is episode number 103. And in today's show, we're talking about the 2018 flick, Mandy. This is a movie that I've been wanting to talk about on this show for a very, very long time. And then when I was trying to get yourself onto the show, and I was trying to think of, well, what could we talk about? What would we like to talk about? I thought back to, you know, the conversation we had on Hatchet, and I was like, you know what? I think Mandy's going to just be like the perfect movie for me and you to talk about. So yeah, we're going to talk about that. If you would like to support this show across our social media platforms, you can do so. We're on X at Damned Podcast, Facebook and Instagram's Pod of the Damned, email us at podofthedamned@gmail.com, and you can subscribe to us on Patreon, patreon.com/podofthedamned. And it's always the week when Nico's not here when I don't fuck that up. So, you know, he can just pretend that it never happened. But, Jeff, obviously...
Well, now I really hope he's listening.
Yeah, he fucking better be, I tell you. I think, you know, I know I keep bringing it up, but, like, so many people say to us, oh, are you and Nico really friends? But I feel like sometimes they say that more after episodes where he's not been on, because I just slate him even more so when he's not here. But, you know, I'll never say anything that I won't say to his face. I mean, I'll message him right now and tell him that I'm glad he's not here.
yeah. And when you're close enough, you know, you're close enough to a friend where they're practically a brother. And, you know, I got a couple of brothers. And, yeah, you say some awful shit, both to their face and behind their back, because he's your brother, man. You're gonna see him next week anyway.
Yeah, exactly. But obviously, as I said, Jeff, you are the host of the Movies for Days podcast, a podcast that I've been on, a podcast that I'm a big, big fan of. But for anyone who's listening, for anyone who maybe hasn't heard your show before, would you like to tell everyone a little bit about your podcast, where it can be found, what sort of things you're covering at the moment as well?
Absolutely, thanks. And is this coming out next week?
This episode will be coming out next week, yes.
All right, cool. All right. So yeah, man, thank you. The Movies for Days podcast is a weekly deep dive into whatever movie from whatever decade with whatever guest happens to be there that week. It's all about examination and celebration at the network. We really just love bringing you that easy access, non-pretentious movie chat that you can vibe with. And we have a lot of different sub-series at the network. Currently, we've got number 8 in our Tarantino Jamborino sub-series covering Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. The movie's so huge, it had to be a two-parter. So that's what's happening right now. Our last episode from last week was Mortal Kombat 1995. And coming up in a couple of weeks when we're all done with Tarantino Jamborino, we're bringing you The Shed, which is an amazingly awesome low-budget vampire movie that I'm just in love with. So it's fucking Movies for Days at the network, man. Check us out. I'm on Twitter at Movies Days, spelled Days with a Z because I was a 90s kid when everything was extreme. We're also on the Slasher app at Movies 4 Days. It's the same damn thing, but stick a number 4 in the middle. And we are proud members of the You Run Podcast Network and YouRunPodcast.com. So that's all the spiel I've got to veal. And man, I'm just pleased as fucking punch to be here and can't wait to have you back on Movies for Days, Ian, because you're a damn fine guest. Well, and you run a damn fine show here at Pod of the Damned.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And the same goes for you as well. I do also just want to give a quick shout out to the You Run podcast, because that is also a show that I have guested on as well. I'm going a wee ways back there with Scott. I was on there, believe it or not, talking about Dr. Sleep, which, you know, if anyone who has listened to this show for a long time will know, you know, that's a movie that I don't need to be reviewing anymore. I've said all I need to say about that movie. But I was on there talking about Dr. Sleep. So a big shout out to Scott and the Euron podcast as well, because that's a damn fine show too.
Oh, yeah. Couldn't agree more. So glad to be a part of that club.
Yeah.
Speaking of clubs, Mandy, terrible. Nah, there are no clubs. There are no clubs in this at all. There's a big fucking axe.
There is a big fucking axe. And with that being said, we're going to go and we're going to talk about Mandy.
Embrace. His fist closed around the serpent's eye. Strange and eternal.
I need you to get me that girl I saw. Do you know what to do?
A special one, Mandy. I too am a special one. Let us be so very special together.
So what are you gonna do with that man?
I'm going hunting.
So what you hunting?
Crazy evil.
You think you're so in love? I'll show you love.
Oh man, they wronged you. You exude the cosmic darkness.
Glowed from within, strange and eternal.
Okay, This movie was released in 2018, was directed by Panos Cosmatos, and stars Nicolas Cage, Andrea Riseborough, and Linus Roach. The IMDb plot is as follows. The enchanted lives of a couple in a secluded forest are brutally shattered by a nightmarish hippie cult and their demon biker henchmen, propelling a man into a spiraling, surreal rampage of vengeance. You know, when I first watched this movie, I think it was very much during that sort of phase of time for me where Nicolas Cage wasn't really it at the minute. You know, he went through that sort of phase where he was just doing, you know, in fairness to him, he was doing what he wanted to do. You know, he wasn't doing big budget Hollywood movies anymore. He was doing small movies, but he was, you know, maybe not always given the best performances, or maybe the movie parts just wasn't quite right for him. And then Mandy came out, and I was just like, what the fuck is this thing that I've just watched? I remember the first, like, I wish I was on hallucinogenics watching this the first time I watched it. I mean, like, how did you feel, like, just off the top of the bat, like, before we get into, like, any sort of actual parts of the movie, what was going through your mind when you first saw this?
I was lucky enough to see this in the theater at the Music Box here in Chicago. And so I was in a big dark room with a handful of cine freaks that were there to vibe, and big screen, perfect sound. And within the first few minutes of the opening credits, I was feeling this vibe. And I was saying to myself, okay, we're all going for a swim. And it was amazing. Everybody was on board with what the movie was doing. You know what I mean? Like, not to get too far ahead, but the scene where the head is on fire and he picks up the cigarette and he lights the cigarette off the flaming severed head. Everybody in the audience, it's like they were watching and egging him on, but it wasn't like they were overtaking. They were still being respectful of the movie, but it was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then when he lit the cigarette and took the drag, everybody went, It really captured everybody's emotions. And for me, I've been a Nicolas Cage fan for a long time. I've actually got a sub-series devoted to him called Rage for Cage, where we pit two Nicolas Cage movies against each other. And yeah, one of the first episodes we did covered Mandy. It, to me, kicked off this great era of his career where he's doing both the serious and the crazy and getting all this amazing praise, and rightfully so. After this, we got such gems as Color Out of Space, which I continue to stand. I love that movie. Mom and Dad, which I don't think is as good, but is really great and is in this same kind of milieu. Prisoners of the Ghostland, which is just completely gonzo, but it's awesome. But then you've also got other wonderful offerings like Pig, which for me was the movie of the year it came out. It was his greatest performance, I think, since Leaving Las Vegas. And it's because of stuff like Mandy happening when it did that I think he was able to springboard into this. He leaned into this curve. And so it was huge for me seeing this for the first time. If I'm not mistaken, my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, and I went to see this as well. So like I saw it by myself and then I saw it with her.
Yeah.
And it was an early date. And it was one of those moments of, oh, she's a keeper.
Yeah, that's definitely when you know, isn't it? If she's going to
Mandy, but yeah, man, the movie.
No, carry on.
Oh, just the movie. It really grabs you in this stylistic, emotional way that I don't think we were getting a lot of at the time, and movies have started to embrace that in the last few years. I think a similar but less vibrant example would be Robert Eggers in The Witch.
Yeah,
that also really pulls you into its vibe, and it makes you live that way whether you want to or not. But of course, it's not as colorful. It's not as vibrant.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. Like you say, you know, it was a very bizarre time. You know, Nicolas Cage is one of those really sort of weird actors, isn't he? Where, you know, He's kind of done everything at this point. You know, he did those serious, really sort of, you know, high praise, high value roles earlier in his career, like you mentioned earlier. He's done like that. He's been an action star. You know, I'm sorry, but Con Air will always be, you know, one of my favorite movies. Not because it's a particularly good movie, but just because that movie's fucking batshit insane. You know, and then
oh yeah, I love The Rock.
Yeah, exactly. The Rock. That's another great movie. And then, of course, like you say, he came later in his career. And it's interesting because I think you're absolutely right. This has, I think, has gone a little bit under the radar. I think this is actually quite an important movie because you obviously mentioned Robert Eggers' The Witch there, and you can bring in his later work as well. You know, you can bring in The Lighthouse as well, you know, as being sort of examples of this, but on the other scale. Obviously, this is so, you know, colourful and, you know, and just... It's really a bombardment on the senses, as movie. But that takes it to the other extreme. It's in the same fashion, but on the other end of the scale. And I think, you know, these movies, like you say, really have sort of become embraced a little bit more. I remember when Mandy did first come out, and there was a lot of people out there, especially, you know, maybe people who were seen to be like sort of higher brow, you know, and people who tried to be, you know, movie snobs and things like that, who definitely was critic sort of panning the fuck out of this movie. You know, and in actual fact, you know, this is a great example of a movie. I wasn't as lucky as you. I didn't get to see this in the theater. I don't really remember Mandy getting like a huge UK run in the theaters. If it did, it certainly didn't reach my part of the country. So I wasn't able to go see this in theaters. I think seeing like I also give my opinions on this movie from what I've seen it, you know, from home. But I think seeing this in the theaters would be a completely different experience to what you could possibly experience in that at home.
You never want to come off like a movie bro cliche, but it really is true. It's an experience. Mm-hmm. And it was a time when movies had kind of stopped caring about that. And obviously I'm painting with broad strokes. I don't mean all movies, but you know, most of what you can see as a casual working class movie fan. I mean, fuck dude, I want to be down at the art house seeing every single goddamn thing too, but these cost money and they take time to go and see. So it's like, there is such a thing as feeling a drought of specific vibrant creativity in the cinematic landscape. And I feel like the late 2000s into the early 20 teens, we were in a bit of a malaise, especially where horror and genre cinema were concerned. And it was like Robert Eggers and Julia Drew Carnoux and other very courageous, vibrant maniacs who are ushering in this new era of horror that I think is so awesome because the umbrella is spread so fucking wide. You know, I've made no bones about it when I've interacted with you guys about my feelings on the Terrifier movies. I do not like those movies. I think they're not very good. But I recognize the skill involved in, you know, everything they're doing. And I love that there is an audience out there that is getting fed that loves this and is picking it up because I'm getting all the other stuff I love too. So it's great that there's so much out there for everybody.
Yeah, no, you're 100% correct. And Ren, who you'll be familiar with, I'm sure, who was on our last episode on The Black Phone, he said it best, you know, when he was on our Terrifier episode. You know, he didn't like, you know, we were talking about Terrifier 2. He was like, I don't like that fucking movie. But because of that movie and the success, specifically Terrifier 2, Terrifier itself was a success, but it paled in comparison to what Terrifier 2 achieved. You know, because of the success of that movie, you know, we got to see all these great other movies that we got theater runs that would never ever in a million years have gotten a theater run had it been released, you know, 10 to 15 years prior. And you know, and you're also talking about this sort of golden, this sort of age of horror and cinema that we're going through. And you know, I've long said on this show and on other shows as well that these last sort of 7-8 years I think have truly been an absolute golden era for horror. And in my opinion, a golden era of horror that actually challenges, you know, when people say, well, what was the greatest era of horror? And, you know, 90% of people will tell you it was the 1980s. You know, I think the last six or seven years really, really can, you know, hold a candle up to that in a completely different fashion, because the movies that are getting released today are nothing like the movies that are getting released then. But, you know, in terms of just sheer volume and quality, and not only that, acceptance as well, horror starting to become a more widely accepted genre. And I think for us as long-term horror fans, and you'll know this as a lifelong horror fan as well, you know, growing up, horror was not an accepted genre. And so to now suddenly be almost, it's a bizarre feeling to, you know, start talking about this and have it be much more widely appreciated and widely accepted. And it's a great thing. It's a great thing.
Yeah, it's the, you know, it's the stuff of nerd culture, and it's getting embraced more and more, I think, as the generation that identified in different ways has come up and started kind of taking control of the moving and shaking of society. You've got video game culture, you've got sci-fi culture, you've got horror culture, all these different fandoms that are really growing and embracing their own legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of spreading like wildfire. And I do think it's a good thing because it leads to a wider acceptance of these things and an ability to go further with them in more interesting ways. And yeah, I totally agree that we're in sort of a new golden age of horror that you could compare to like the 70s and 80s, but it's what's similar about it is that it is daring. It is answering questions that have long been unanswered, and it's giving people stuff they didn't know they were hungry for. It's doing all the things that were being done back then, just in different ways, because so much time has passed. We're different people. We're different film fans.
Yeah.
I think things are kicking ass right now. I'm glad to be living it.
Yeah. You know, well, that's, you know, I'm an early 90s child. So, you know, I didn't get to live through that golden era of the late 70s and the 80s, you know. My regular co-host Nico, you know, he was the 80s baby, so he remembers that time. That came just a little bit too earlier for me, but you know, when I was growing up, we're talking late 90s into those noughties and into that sort of early teens that you were talking about, and that's when I was sort of, you know, a teenager and growing up, and you know, where we did have that malaise, and you know, there wasn't stuff that, you know, there was still plenty coming out, but it wasn't really pushing the envelope, you know, the way that certain movies are today. And listen, don't get me wrong, there are plenty of movies that are still coming out today that are just your sort of traditional horror fodder and, you know, your traditional horror fare. But for me, even those types of movies are done to just like such a higher standard because things have moved on so much, you know, from 30, 40 years ago, you know, in terms of what people can do with effect. You know, you can do a lot more on a lot less money. You can, you know, budgets don't have to be huge. And again, you know, I'm sure our listeners are absolutely fed up at me bringing it up, but you go back to things like Terrifier and Terrifier 2 and what they achieved with the money that they had for that movies. The budget for the first Terrifier movie was $30,000, give or take, you know, which is absolutely nothing. That, you know, that is nothing. That is zero money to make a movie, you know. So it just goes to show, you know, how much more creative, and how far we're progressing, I think, as a genre.
Yeah, it's really a beautiful time to be a horror fan because not only do you have all this great new daring stuff that's coming out and that's more readily accessible than ever, but also more ways to talk about it and share it than ever before, and also more access to the annals of the great horror history than ever before. My fucking mother-in-law got me a Blu-ray of the Blue Underground Blu-ray special edition of Maniac from 1980. She got this for me for Christmas because my wife was good enough to tell her it's what I wanted. And she's just awesome enough to do that. But like a woman of her advanced years was able to get this for me as a Christmas gift. We are living in truly blessed times, Ian.
Now, speaking of blessed times, we maybe just a little bit are starting to sound like the children of the new dawn, which is, you know, our main antagonists of this movie. I'm gonna drag us ever so slightly, shuddering and screaming, back to the movie that we're actually talking about today. We've obviously discussed Nicolas Cage and his performances, and we'll probably jump back onto him because I probably all have a few other points to make about him, and specifically with this movie and some of his other things as well. But I want to sort of shift focus just a little bit because, you know, there's so many different moving parts to this. You know, we can talk about, you know, Nicolas Cage and Red. We can talk about Mandy. But I want to talk a little bit about the Children of the New Dawn because, again, about, you know, speaking and pushing the envelope and pushing the line a little bit. And you know, maybe this isn't a new thing because I feel like religion specifically is something that has been sort of poked and prodded at, not just in horror, but throughout cinema, you know, for many, many years. You know, you could go all the way back, you know, talk about, you know, Monty Python, for example, with Life of Brian. You know, that was a hugely controversial movie at the time for, you know, how it poked fun at religion. And, you know, obviously, I don't particularly know where your religious beliefs lie. I I'm very, very open with the fact that I am an atheist and I'm very anti-religion. And I, but you know, people are absolutely entitled to their own beliefs and, you know, choosing to their cultures and, you know, the comfort that some people may take with that. I have absolutely no issues with people who take comfort in religion, who use it to better themselves, blah, blah, blah. However, I think organized religion and organizations within religion are tools to exploit people and ultimately they make people's lives worse, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, we're in a pretty similar lane there. So yeah, you can feel very comfortable expressing these things to me.
Okay,
because, yeah,
I fucking hate religion.
I mean, it's like, yeah. Crusades, child slavery. These things, they're really not as ancient as we like to think.
Yeah. No, 100%.
Yeah, they're,
you know, like,
they're rooted in that. And yeah, I think this movie is a bit of a rebuke of that, of the sort of evil, misogynistic power that can be wielded through these Judeo-Christian ethics and mythologies and fucking organized religious systems.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and again, I, you know, just want to emphasize, because I'm sure there will be lots of our listeners out there who do have religious beliefs and have things like that. I'm not necessarily talking about your general everyday person on the street. You know, people can have religious beliefs. I have family members who have religious beliefs, and, you know, they don't, you know, you can be a Christian and not hate gay people. You can be a Christian and not hate women. You can be a, you know, and all of these sorts of things. You can believe in helping each other and wanting to pull each other up and community and all of those sorts of things without, you know, subscribing to the very nasty things that a lot of religion does. But what this movie does do, I think it shows you a perfect example of the sort of, almost like the yin and the yang between them, because you here you've got Red and Mandy, who basically they're just existing. You know, they're you know, Red's a lumberyard worker. He's an ex-alcoholic. You've got Mandy, who works as a gas station clerk, I think she works as, you know, but she's an artist, she's an author. But they're just living in this little wooded area. They're living in their own world. They don't bother anyone. They're just living their lives. They're happy together, and they're just living their lives. And then you've got the Children of the New Dawn with this, their leader, Jeremiah Sand, which is a name that makes me want to punch him in the face anyway. And don't get me wrong, no offense to the actor, the name Linus Roach kind of makes me want to punch him in the face as well. But, however, I will give him credit for is I think he's absolutely fantastic at portraying this role in this movie. I think he does an incredible job here because he, like you say, he just embodies this sort of self-centered, selfish, just, you know, world revolving around him. No one else has, and in his mind, you know, no one else has meaning unless they are following him and worshipping him. No one else can have any sort of life goals that doesn't revolve around him. And I just think this whole thing is just such a good representation for what a lot of religion actually is, you know, deep down. You know, they'll put out on the front, you know, about, you know, helping each other and, you know, bringing each other up. But ultimately, deep down, it's, you know, worship us or your life's not worth living. You're going to go to hell, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, the ways in which a cultish leader can become a tyrant and people will just follow along in a goose step fashion. It's also a great, I think, condemnation of the fragile male ego, an examination of how harmful it can be if it gets shattered, right? Because this whole thing goes from bad to worse because he strips naked in front of her and she fucking laughs and she can't stop laughing. And that's when it gets really bad. And the dude was already this narcissist with total fragile ego issues. I totally agree. I think Linus Roach plays this so well. I think everybody in the Children of the New Dawn group are giving such great performances with their creepy dilated eyes. And let me ask, did it seem to you like he's a bit of a Charlie Manson inspired character because he's a failed musician who then started a cult that was like based in fucking constant LSD and a lot of, you know, exploitation of the, you know, the young women that were involved in the group, and also kind of retooling really basic Christian ideals to make himself the cult leader.
The similarities are not, you know, lost on me, and I think it's something there for everyone to see. You know, the similarities, like you say, are very Manson like about the failed musician. I think they both called their followers pigs as well, which is something else. You know, the similarities really, really are there. But you're absolutely right, you know, this sort of narcissistic, fragile ego of this person, you know, as I was saying earlier, you know, these two people are just living their lives, you know, they're not harming anyone. But Jeremiah Sands sets eyes on Mandy one day, you know, that scene where, you know, they're driving past and he sees Mandy for the first time. And he then just takes it upon himself to essentially destroy their whole world because, you know, number one, you know, they sort of infiltrate and kidnap and hold them hostage. But there was really no way for, once that first sighting had passed, for Red and Mandy to continue their lives as they had it, because Jeremiah Sand had decided that it wasn't going to be. And, you know, again, that goes to that sort of narcissism and fragile ego of him. Listen, no one likes to be laughed at, but the response to being laughed at, if you are, is not to burn someone to death.
Yeah, I'd say, if I could, I know, hot take, little bit of an overreaction.
I would just ever so slightly.
It was a very hot take. Now, here's the other thing, right? Is this also to me, because this is something you spoke about, is that all they're doing, Red and Mandy, is living their lives. They've got this quiet little hideaway. I love the shot of them in the boat, you know, from way up high, and he's just telling her something. It doesn't matter what. He's animated. He's telling her something. They're just out having maybe a little row and a fish, and they're going to fucking have a little camp. And it's fucking early 80s. It's the Reagan 80s. They get to just be disconnected from all of that noise and violence and hate and nonsense. And this movie to me is also very much about the forcing together, if you will, true love versus soulless idolatry. And because Jeremiah is so angered by their love, which is an actual true love, and it's the kind of love he covets, it's the kind of love he'll never actually have from his followers, because he can only keep them through, you know, fucking drug abuse and exploitation and, you know, reworking their brains and forcing one of them to star in a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie. And like, this is awful. This is torturous behavior to do to your followers. And so it's like their devotion to him is hollow. And deep down, he knows that. And so it's like he's jealous of this, and he wants to take her. He wants to possess her. He thinks he has some God-given right to everything around him. It's like he's drunk his own Kool-Aid at this point. And holy fucking shit, it gets awful and violent because they've got access to those Cenobite biker motherfuckers. And they've got the Horn of Abraxas, and they've got Richard Brake making drugs. And it's just like, how does this one guy have all these connections? He made one record. He made one fucking record, and he's got these robes. And I don't know. I don't know. It's just, it goes nuts, man. It goes from bad to worse.
If anyone was going to hand you some drugs to use, though, Richard Brake's probably a good man to do it. I would trust that man with some.
Yeah, but man, keep the tiger in the cage. I mean, I get it. At that point, we were letting the tiger out of the cage. It wasn't lost on me, you know? And earlier, he had his tiger shirt on. It wasn't lost on me. But, like, if I was really there, I'd be like, whoa, damn, bro, wait till I'm gone. Don't be letting that tiger out right now, please.
No, but what I think, you know, is really, you know, really, really interesting there as well. And I think it's one of the things that makes not just me, but probably a wider audience as well, relate to this movie so much. You know, you talk about that scene in the boat, you know, where, they again, you know, they're having their little camp, they're maybe doing a little fishing. And there's something just so relatable, I think. You know, I don't think you could show me a person or many people in the world who you could look at that and look at them existing in that moment. You know, maybe not for forever, you know, because that's not everyone's ideals for forever. You're not telling me that any of us at that moment haven't just wanted to completely disassociate ourselves from the world, go away to a lake or into some wooded area and just live for a short period in complete harmony with the person you're with in peace, with, like you say, without the aggressive nature of everyday life, without all the violence and hate and anger that you see, you know, away from social media, away from, you know, a you know, a 9-to-5 job or whatever job it is you've got. You know, everyone wants a little slice of that. And I think that's what also helped to make this movie work so well, because, you know, we spend a good portion of this movie, you know, sort of following them. You know, we don't just get, you know, fleeting sightings of them in the beginning. We do spend a good chunk of the movie. The pacing of this movie is very odd. You know, it works, but it's very, very odd. You know, this first half of the movie, very slow and methodical and things like that. And then, you know, the world changes and it's almost like reality. It's bizarre because the second half of this movie is so out there and so insane, you know, for lack of a better word. But it's almost like reality is hitting people in the ass and it's being like, yes, you could maybe have a taste of this peace that they had. But at the end of the day, the world will get you back.
The movie feels a bit to me like a death metal concept album. And, you know, disc one, if you will, is the two of them and their love and their slice of paradise. And the slow dread of the encroaching evil that we, the audience, kind of know about, but don't know just how bad it's going to get. And then you have the crescendo at the end of, you know, disc one, if you will, of this horrible murder which has taken place. And then so disc two is going to be the harder, heavier, more wild shit that you're really hunkered down and ready for because you went through everything you went through. You know, I mean, it might be trite, but it's just because it rings so true with good storytelling. We care that Mandy has been taken from the world of the movie because we spent all this time with her, and honestly her spirit and her energy continue to just govern everything that happens after that. She still has such a presence in the film after that, but it's all in like dream sequences and in music and in light and in energy. This constant reminder of what he's fighting for.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's something that's, you know, it's so overlooked because this is something that, you know, 99% of movies don't have. They don't have this sort of energy of character, especially after, you know, a character has been killed off. Don't get me wrong. Tons of movies have done it where a character has been killed off and, you know, we maybe get a flashback scene or, you know, some sort of visions with them later. But for, you know, in terms of, like you say, just bringing that absolute energy, because it is the spirit of Mandy that is controlling every action for Red. It's the spirit of Mandy that is controlling his, that is his motivation for the entire second half of the movie. And like you say, we see that through color and through visions and through animation as well. And, you know, it's just, it's there's so much there. It's absolutely incredible. Another thing I do like about this as well, you know, we sort of danced around that sort of scene where, you know, Mandy, you know, meets her maker, you know, where they burn her alive. But what I really like is we as an audience also along with the character Red, because after that, you know, we see Red escape from, you know, he's, you know, bound with barbed wire. We get that bathroom scene, which is an incredibly hard-hitting scene, you know, and I feel like that's a scene that would have been so easy to not come across correctly. It would have been so easy for that to just not feel quite right, because it's just him, you know, and he's just downing that, chugging that bottle of vodka, and, you know,
seeing it in the theater with a crowd was really interesting because it goes on for so long. Mm-hmm. And you got to understand, seeing that for the first time, you're not sure how long we're going to spend in this room with him, just screaming his grief and diving into that hidden bottle that, you know, anybody that knows anything about alcoholism and recovery knows it's very common. You've got that hidden booze for just when things get way too bad. And the audience reaction, there was some nervous laughter, especially when it went on just a little longer than it was expected to. But then as it continued and we got deeper into how sorrowful these moans and these bellows are, everybody really locked in to how horrible he was feeling. Yeah. And it's amazing. As if this was some fucking Shakespeare play, he would have had some long soliloquy that's very poetic with a lot of flowery language. And yet this, in all of its barbarism, gives us such a journey of his emotional grief cycle, dealing with, I can't believe it, I'm accepting it, this is horrible, I'm super sad, okay, I'm resolved to fucking do something about this. Because at the end, he's angry. Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing is as well, you know, Nicolas Cage we know as a person who can deliver an incredible performance without saying a single word. And no, I'm not referencing Willy's Wonderland, whilst I think that's a great movie. Maybe not quite on the along the emotional depth that we're talking about here. But he is a person who can be on the screen and give an absolutely incredible performance. And you're right, this scene does go on for so much longer. And again, you're absolutely right, you know, about, you know, a big thing about addiction is that, and it doesn't have to be alcohol, it can be any form of addiction, any form of substance abuse. People who are recovering will often have hidden stashes around their properties and things like that, you know. And it's just, you know, most of us have lost loved ones, and unfortunately, you know, most of us have lost friends and family, and you know, that's part of life, right? Touch wood, for the majority of us, hopefully we never ever have to see, you know, one of our loved ones being burned to death in front of us. And I think there's a part of you that almost just can't relate to that, because, you know, we've all lost loved ones and felt sorrow and felt anger, you know, especially if, you know, it's been with, you know, an illness or someone who's maybe been taken too young or anything like that. Of course, you know, you go through those emotions, but to have that sort of vision, to have to be made to watch as the one person you love in front of you is so cruelly taken away. And what I love about this as well is, even though that scene is so impactful, it gives us, the audience, a moment to process and accept and breathe as well. I think it would have been very, very easy as a movie for this scene to happen, him to escape, and almost immediately, you know, start to go on that rampage. But we as an audience get, you know, 5 to 10 minutes to breathe. We see that scene in the bathroom. We then see the scene of him going to see his friend in the trailer to pick up his weapons. And then it's fucking batshit after that.
We need that. We need that sequence with Bill Duke as Carruthers to not only breathe, because I completely agree with everything you've just said, it gives us some necessary context of what he's up against, both for our understanding and for his. And it's also, I never get tired of rewatching this scene. I've seen this movie several times. This scene is amazing because these two actors are amazing and they understand how to lick this dialogue, and they spit it so perfectly. I love when Bill Duke tells him, look, you got to understand what you're going up against. It's heavier than you think. You probably won't come out alive. And he just goes, don't be negative.
I fucking love Bill Duke anyway. I've loved Bill Duke since fucking Predator came out. You know, I think he's an incredible actor. I think it's a massively, massively underrated one. And, you know, I was really, really pleased to see him in this movie. And you're right, those two, you know, they're masters of their craft when it comes to, you know, script and how to deliver things. You're right, that scene is, I think that scene carries a lot more weight than people may give it credit for in terms of its importance to the overall film. I think it could easily be dismissed as just a, right, he's just going to sort of tool up kind of scene. But it actually holds a lot of gravitas, and, like, again, part of that, you know, breathing process and so on for the rest of the movie. Because once that scene's passed, we'll get into it, because we haven't really talked much about the, you know, the fucking biker mice from Mars here.
Shit, yeah!
You know, this is when
the Cenobikers.
The Cenobikers, yes. So I believe... and of course, and in that scene as well, you've also got Bill Duke, I think Crothers, I think is his credited name, who does sort of give some sort of an explanation for what they are. He says they're former drug couriers who became sadomasochists after consuming a bad batch of LSD. I wonder if it's, you know, LSD they got off of Richard Brake that, you know, sent them over the edge. But, you know, we get some incredible scenes in the second half of this movie with these demon bikers, if you will. And, you know, Nicolas Cage, there's some truly mind-boggling moments, you know, when you find out one of them has, you know, essentially a sword for a penis. It's, you know, they're in that little sort of shack or whatever it is you want to call it, just with a huge mound of drugs. It's literally piled up onto the table.
And they've clearly been there for ages. There's a dead couple that are like, I don't know, not half rotted, but maybe a quarter rotted, 25% rotted. That, you know, they clearly like took this from them and killed them, but never did anything with their bodies, which is fucked. And it looks, if I'm not mistaken, it looks as if they've sexually violated the dead old man. These guys are just completely over the edge. It's, I mean, it's unfathomable.
Yeah.
And it's so well done. They all have really funky black leather based armor infused black metal Ninja Turtle villain kind of armor. One of them has fucking spikes just all over, to the point that when Nicolas Cage tries to run him down in his truck, it makes the truck crash and flip. Because that's how armored he is.
I'm pretty sure I saw one of them two, one or two of them in Slipknot.
yeah.
but no, you're right as well. And then in that scene as well, you know, you're talking about that. You know, you've got the dead couple there, and things rotting, and the place is a mess and horrible. And there's one of them's just there watching fucking porn on the TV as well. And it's just like these guys are so detached from any kind of reality. Like there's just not like there's nothing they won't do. There's nothing they won't. And it makes them. That's what makes them such an intimidating villain. But I think as well, because it would have been, again, would have been really easy for this movie to something make them these kind of sort of undefeatable monsters. But, you know, these were just people.
Yep.
And that's the crux of it. And Nicolas Cage is able to defeat them. And it almost get, again, for me, it goes back to what we were talking about with, you know, the cult and the Children of the New Dawn and organized religion, about making things bigger than they actually are, making things more important than they actually are, to the point where you've got Bill Duke's character being like, these are some bad fucking dudes, you're probably going to die. But at the end of the day, they're just people.
Yeah, and I think it does correlate to Jeremiah. They are saying that they are special. They believe they are special. This doesn't actually mean that they are mystical or special or have a connection to some otherworldly power. They just behave as if they do, but they're just fucking people. And throughout this story, especially this latter half of this story, Red takes them down one by one. Yeah. Now, it's not without toil. It's not without sacrifice and danger. I mean, if I fucking tried to do what he's doing, I'd probably die. But, you know, Red is uniquely equipped to prevail in this situation because of everything he has suffered. And I would also argue in a hippy dippy kind of way, because he is infused and guided by the power of Mandy's spirit. Because I think, and this is something my wife, who is a very witchy kind of a gal, she and I have talked a bit about this. I think that Mandy was supposed to be kind of a seer. I think she's supposed to kind of have some, connection to that other realm, and it influences her writing, it influences her art, and she's not trying to ever misuse it or flaunt it. And the movie's not really about that, but that maybe that's something Jeremiah was also fixated on because he recognized it, or maybe he even shares that a little bit.
I think it's more he coveted it, you know. I think it's something that he didn't actually have. You know, and he saw that energy, because it's referenced multiple times that, you know, that first half of the movie, that Mandy does have this sort of other realm sort of vibe around her. You know, that's definitely something that I think we see quite a few times. And I think when Jeremiah sees her, not only that first time, but again, in the scene where he tries to convert her, you know, he can sense that energy, and I think he wants it for himself. It's almost like he's trying to take the energy from her and make it a part of himself by indoctrinating her into this cult. So I think you're absolutely spot on there.
And that, how about that shot in that attempted conversion scene where it's like bleeding their faces back and forth together, especially on the big screen with the soundscape they created. Oh, Jesus. This movie is an experience, and it's really, really something that I never get tired of revisiting.
I do still want to try it on some sort of hallucinogens, to be honest, just to see what happens. But I have to say, you also talk about, you know, if I was Red, I definitely wouldn't have survived that massive bump he takes after he kills the, he gets rid of the demons.
Because... Oh, yeah. And Yeah, and then he takes a little dab of the demon acid just to be like, oh, let's see what they're all on about. And I mean, like, it's literally face melting. And I think these things help him on his journey the same way if you're like a knight going on some weird journey through an enchanted forest, you would have to get some potions along the way. Yeah. Like, I really do see some connection there.
Yeah, no, 100%. And, you know, it's not even just like, it's not even going as far, obviously, that it's heavy drug use in this movie, but you know yourself, like, even, you know, if you've been, you know, if you're out with friends and you're drinking alcohol, you know, it gives you that, it gives you a sense of, not immortality, but, you know, it gives you that more sort of power, like, you know, I can't be hurt as much. It gives you a sense that you can do things that you maybe couldn't actually do, you know? And so I think there's a little part of that in there as well, you know? And again, maybe leading to the sort of confidence, the overconfidence of both, you know, Jeremiah and the bikers, because they're constantly on these drugs, these hallucinogens, and they just believe they're capable of anything.
Yeah. And it just keeps getting more insane. And I'll still contend that the spirit of Mandy is guiding and protecting Red, and that's part of why he prevails. But it's also not without his own grit and determination. And it just keeps getting more and more awesome. Not unlike a video game. You know, he's got to take out the drone biker dudes who are just really heavy and really dangerous. And we get some beautiful dispatchments. We've got bloody throat slits. We've got a fucking arrow going through the throat. We got some good stuff in here. But then, of course, he also has his chainsaw fight.
There we go. I was literally just the way to bring that up. Yes, we get possibly one of the like most badass chainsaw fights. This is just like, it's just like, you're at a part of the movie where, you know, he's overcome a couple of the members, because most of the bikers are, you know, he's dealt with them. And then we have this chainsaw fight, and this guy's got this huge logging chainsaw, which is obviously so much bigger than your, you know, your traditional, you know, Evil Dead style chainsaw. You know, I just pictured Ash Williams coming off the tree line and being like, that, you know, his Crocodile Dundee moment. You know, that's not a chainsaw, this is a chainsaw, you know.
It feels like Texas Chainsaw 2, you know, with Dennis Hopper coming up like, I'm gonna get ya. Fucking chainsaws.
But, you know, this chainsaw fight is just absolutely fucking badass as hell, you know, and you know, it's just incredible. And I think the thing is, for me with this movie, you know, we've talked about a lot about the energy and, you know, the colorfulness and the general cinematography of this movie, because this regardless of how, and even if people don't like this movie is beautiful. It's so beautiful to watch, you know, in terms of the colors, the shots, whatever you want to say. You might not like the content. If you don't like this movie, that's your prerogative to not like this movie. But no one can deny that this isn't a beautiful movie. Even though when we're getting later in the film and we maybe are starting to hit, you know, those sort of more high-paced actions parts of the movie, like the chainsaw fight, we still have this beautiful color palette in the background going on. And I think that's what speaks to what you were saying about Mandy and her energy, because this is that I feel like that's Mandy's energy, the color. And the movie is constant, and she's just like always there.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And you know, similarly, when he meets with Richard Brake, and it's nice. It's like he's like this sort of oracle, you know, potion wizard, sorcerer, creator guy, you know, who kind of doesn't want to get involved. He can literally taste it in the air what has happened to Red. He just knows, and he says, "You know what? I'm not even going to try to protect these assholes. This is how you can get to them. Just leave me out of it." Because, yeah, I agree. They went too far. And it's amazing. They're able to sort of have that communication without actually speaking a word of dialogue. I feel like the movie asks a lot of acceptance and buy-in from the audience. However, I think the movie focuses on the details and the necessary swings of emotion and the consistency of style so much that you're really rewarded if you just give over to that. It's so rich and layered, and the stuff that we don't need to talk about, we don't need to talk about. You can infer so much about this world. And so, yeah, the journey continues on to fucking take out the weird Clem looking bitch who like was spitting on the car to clean it. And, you know, he's already taken out, well, Brother Swan. I think that actor gives a really good performance.
Yep.
and that's a sexy little dispatchment with his axe that he forged himself. Again, very like, you know, old school fantasy knight in the enchanted forest kind of shit. I also love that that's when you get the title card, Mandy, after he's made the axe. It almost, to me, feels like that's the name of the axe. So when he's killing somebody, you are literally being killed by Mandy. Yeah. You are being killed by her.
Yeah, and I love the fact, because that title sequence as well, it comes virtually halfway, almost exactly half at the halfway point of the movie. You know, we've just seen her, you know, be killed. He's forged this axe. Like you say, it's like the spirit of Mandy, you know, has left her body and now resides within this axe that he has forged. And that's where her spirit is, and that's why she's always with him.
This was a question I had, because this is something my wife brought up that I never considered. So they already have a young, beautiful gal in their tribe, and that's the gal that Jeremiah has been favoring in his bed as of late.
Yeah.
But now he's fixated on
Sister
Mandy.
Sister Lucy, I believe, is her name.
In all the times I watched this movie, it never occurred to me that she could be Swan's daughter. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason that she's a part of all this. He pulled her into it because that's his daughter. And I never considered that. My wife, upon seeing the movie one time, said, oh, yeah, that's definitely what's going on. And it's fucked up. It's part of why these people are so fucked up. And I was like, whoa, I never caught that. Did you ever consider that? Had that occurred to you?
It hadn't occurred to me on like the first few times I'd watched it. The first few times I'd watched it, I just maybe assumed that they'd picked up this sort of young, impressionable girl and, you know, had maybe indoctrinated her in the same way that they were trying to indoctrinate Mandy. It wasn't until, you know, much later on where I started to maybe put that things together. And I think especially for me, it comes with the reason why Red spared her, you know, in that sort of big finale, is not because she's necessarily a part of this group, even though she is. She's someone who maybe just doesn't share their core beliefs, is there because this is what she was born into, rather than someone who chose that path. Everyone else, like you say, Brother Swan and is it Mother Marlene, I think it is?
I think so.
You know, these are people,
man,
who have chosen this path and have chosen to give themselves over to Jeremiah. And yeah, we have like a couple of younger, impressionable guys in there as well, but they do some pretty heinous shit, you know, and, you know.
Oh, yeah. I ain't crying over them.
Yeah.
But no, I agree. I think it is tied into why he spares her and why Sister Lucy is allowed to live. Sister Marlene, though.
I think as well for me, you know, we get to this sort of big finale scene where, you know, he's reached, you know, Mother Marlene, he's reached Jeremiah, you know, and for us as a viewer at this point, we are so desperate for Red to just get his revenge so that he can, you know, try to then figure out what to do with the rest of his life, you know. I think because he can go and get his revenge, but then, you know, he has to come crashing back down to earth to the fact that he is once again alone, you know, which is something that, you know, they do address in that sort of final scene, you know, when he's in the car and we get that really iconic image, don't we, of him just absolutely covered in blood,
smiling,
just grinning intently at the camera. It's become such an iconic image in horror, you know. It's for me, it's an image that's up there with, you know, Max von Sydow outside the house in The Exorcist. You know, that's the level of imagery that we're talking about here. You know, and he then goes on he turns around and Mandy's there in the car with him, and he's, you know, at least going on in the knowledge that her presence is there with him. And there's such, it's such a huge victory, this end, you know, when he crushes Jeremiah, and it's just all of this we've built up to from that slow beginnings, from those really calm, peaceful, loving scenes that we were getting early on, to this world being turned upside down, to the grief and sorrow that Red felt, and then this absolute rampage that he's gone on, like you say, killing fucking Cenobite bikers, taking copious amounts of drugs, killing, you know, meeting the chemist and the tiger, and killing other people in this cult. he finally gets his hand on Jeremiah. And it, you know what? It is, you referenced it earlier as well. It is almost video game-like, and he's going through the levels and defeating the bosses and the various characters, isn't it?
Yeah, he's got to work his way up the ladder. And, I mean, I thought you might do it, but I'm just going to go ahead and do it for the good of the cause. And Marlena said she was the most tender and sophisticated lover that Jeremiah ever had. And, you know, she went out the way she lived, giving great head.
I thought I knew you had it in the chamber, so I thought I would leave it for you.
That's so sweet of you. And I, that whole confrontation with him and Red is amazing, because he has to like go deep down into what I'm sure Jeremiah thought was going to be his church.
Yeah,
they just had never finished construction, and he's like deep underground, this pulsating red light. It's like a heartbeat. It's like Mandy's heartbeat, taking us slowly but surely deep into these tunnels. And then the fucking confrontation where Jeremiah still tries to do his bullshit used car salesman bit on him to try to get out of this and be like, "You're nothing. I'm anointed by God." And then immediately, suck your dick, man. Please don't do nothing. And yeah, dude, Nick Cage delivering that beautiful line, "I'm your God now." And he crushes his head in his hands, and the eyeball comes. Oh my God. Oh, it's beautiful. Chef's kiss, no notes. I love that shit. And it's interesting you said earlier, because after he gets his sweet bloody revenge, you said he has to come back down to earth. And, you know, and accept that, hey, Mandy's gone and you've done this, but now you have to continue living. I almost contend that we, the audience, never really need to go to that place, because when we pan up from inside the car where he sees her in the car, sort of nodding at him like, yeah, baby, you did it. We can go home and sleep and shit. We pan up and he's got the moons of Jupiter, Mandy's favorite planet, there. And I feel as if this whole experience has grown her sort of spiritual power through all of this sacrifice in her name. And now we're essentially on planet Mandy. It's a lot like Jupiter, but not exactly the same. Now, this is my own interpretation. And I just think it's fucking awesome that that's kind of where they leave us. He's driving away into Jupiter with Mandy by his side. And is she real or not? I don't know at this point, because some very unreal shit has just gone down.
I think the thing is, like, we don't know at this point, but do we even care at this point? Because Red knows. And whether or not Red is correct or incorrect in his knowledge, he knows in his own head what he is going through. And that's what matters to him, you know? You're right. And I think this also goes back to something you were saying earlier in the movie, because, you know, this movie does ask a lot of its viewers. It asks its viewers to accept so much. And we're, like you say, we're both coming to this from a side of, you know, we don't necessarily believe in all of the religious stuff that this movie asks us to do. We might not necessarily believe in real life about all this sort of spiritual stuff. And it can be really easy for us, or for people like us as well, to project that onto the worlds in that these movies create for us. But when we accept it, you know, we are rewarded so greatly for it, as you mentioned earlier, because you get this wonderful, this beautiful closing shot of him driving away. And like you say, panning up to the moons of Jupiter, that it almost doesn't matter for us what happens next to Red. And, you know, that they're so open to what could happen. He maybe did go on and lead the rest of his life with the spirit of Mandy over him. He maybe, you know, and you could take it to the other extreme. I wouldn't be put beyond the realms of the possibility that he ended his own life at the end of that. You know, this is obviously just me projecting and theorizing, but he potentially ended his own life to then, you know, my work here is done sort of thing. I'm now going to go and be with Mandy.
That's entirely possible too. I think that's a fucking totally legit way of seeing it, because everything happening supports that interpretation as well. That's part of what I love about this movie, is how heavy it is on vibes and on mood and on tone and the emotional journey. And why I think a lot of people, when it came out, criticized it, calling it, oh, it's just another revenge movie. And I personally think that when you're doing something that's so stylized and that is so dependent on mood and tone, I think wise decision is to hang it on a simple, tried and true framework. It doesn't have to be a revenge story, but a revenge story is a really good framework to hang these things on.
Yeah.
And I think if you really pay attention to the execution, you would argue that it's being done in such a way that we had not seen in cinema up to that point. It's both refreshing and impressive all at the same time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're when you're asking people to suspend their disbelief so much, you have to have something that's going to take people along for the ride. You have to have something that people can somewhat relate to. And you're right, it doesn't have to be a revenge plot, but this is what this movie is. And you know, for people who maybe, you know, there'll be people out there, and again, this just, I'm trying to not sound like a Twitter. I think this is a very difficult movie to talk about without sounding like a film snob. I'm trying to not to, but there are people out there who maybe aren't that interested in the more spiritual meanings and the meanings behind a lot of things in the movie, and are just there for, you know, they're just along for the ride. And that's when, you know, your revenge plot, and ultimately that's what people will hang on to for a lot. And then there's others who, you know, will look much deeper into the sort of symbolism and what things mean in the movie and things like that. So you're right, you know, the framework of the movie is vitally important, regardless of how simple it may be.
And all of these things are so well executed. I mean, it's amazing how you can you can use these words to describe the same movie. Ethereal, mystical, gentle, romantic, brutal, gut-wrenching, violent, gory, death metal. I know death metal isn't exactly an adjective, but I'm using it as an adjective.
The thing
sure
is, when you're talking
okay
about Mandy, it's a perfect adjective, and everyone knows exactly what it means.
Yeah, it's amazing that they fit so many things into one film, and they, for my money, do it so well.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, it's yeah, it was such a good time revisiting this and being able to chat with you about it. Yeah.
At this point of the episode, I'm going to open up the floor to yourself before we move on to our next segment, because, you know, we've talked quite in depth about the majority of things that I want to talk about. Is there anything else about Mandy that you want to get off your chest? Now is the time. Speak now or forever hold your peace.
And are you trying to, are you saving like trivia and another section?
Once we've done with this main section, we'll go on to some trivia and then we'll go on to the ratings at the very end.
Give me just one sec to just peel back my brain real fast.
No worries at all.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know. I think we have. I think we've hit on pretty much everything. It's
awesome.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Sorry. Cheddar Goblin. Fucking Cheddar Goblin. Can we give it up for Cheddar Goblin? That man, the audience laughed, and it was exactly what it needs to be in that moment. This weird, ugly confirmation that the world doesn't care about you and your problems. It's still going to keep spinning, pal. And it's just so cruel in its humor and so specific and insane in its energy. Fucking Cheddar Goblin forever.
Yeah, you know what? You're absolutely right. It's something that I've completely forgotten about, because you're right. We've all been there where, you know, again, probably not to this extent, but we've all been there where we've just been having the worst fucking day, the worst fucking day. And you'll be walking along the road or you'll be at work and something happens that just doesn't fit with the vibe of your narrative of the day that you're having. But it doesn't give a fuck, because ultimately we're all just tiny, tiny pieces of this huge, insanely huge world. And that's exactly what this moment was, wasn't it? You know, he's just gone through this absolutely horrendous thing. We want this to be so... And you see, again, it also goes back to what you're saying about, you know, these big sort of Shakespearean plays where the characters go through this turmoil and they give these big flowery speeches, and it's also poetic and visual, and that's just not what life is like, is it? You know? And I think that was a great representation of that. Awesome! Right! Let's move on then, if you are happy with that, to our next segment of the show. And we'll talk about some rating. No, we won't. Oh, I'm getting my segments mixed up. It's not like me to fuck up anything on this show. Let's talk about some trivia.
I'm sure if we bashed your head in, all sorts of secrets would come tumbling out.
As always, we'll start off with the finances of this movie. So according to IMDb, this movie had a budget of $6 million, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things, is not a huge amount of money. I think it was a limited theatre run it got, so I'm going to take this figure with a pinch of salt. Again, according to IMDb, it only grossed worldwide $1.6 million, but obviously with streaming deals, I think it's been on streaming services ever since pretty much its release in its initial theatre run. I would imagine this movie has gone on to make a lot more, and I think, you know, we always give the finances of a movie, but as we all know, the finances of the movie really, really aren't that important at all when it comes to, you know, legacy of a movie. And I think one thing this movie will have is a lasting legacy. One of the biggest sort of flops I think we've reviewed on this show, and it's my second favorite movie of all time, and I think one of the most important movies of all time, is John Carpenter's The Thing. That movie bombed so fucking bad, but it's now widely considered to be one of the greatest sort of horror slash sci-fi movies of all time. So finances really don't mean a big deal. I just like to throw it out there for reference. But it's a pity, you know, it didn't get a wider run. I think a lot more people would have benefited from seeing this at the theater.
The movie definitely benefited from word of mouth, though, you know, and it's something I think I had alluded to earlier. It's never been easier to share information about a movie and to get people excited about a movie and to hold out hope that you'll have a chance to see it on a big screen somewhere. If it gets enough attention. And, you know, I think physical media is making a comeback. So it's one of those things where we're really not going to know for a very long time how much movie this quote unquote made.
Yeah.
But it has made such an impression.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And it goes along again, like we said, right at the very beginning as well, with a huge revival of a career as well, you know, for someone who, you know, was maybe a little bit on the outs, was a little bit on the outskirts, was maybe seen to maybe not making the greatest movies in the world. I think this completely, you know, revitalized Nicolas Cage. And, you know, last year as well, you know, he came out with Renfield, you know, which I think was a big hit as well. You know, and I think Nicolas Cage has got some other works coming up in the next year or two as well. You know, I mentioned Willy's Wonderland earlier, you know, a completely different vibe. But for me, it was far better than Five Nights at Freddy's was when that came out. You know, and like you mentioned, Pig,
we also,
you mentioned, yeah, Pig and Caught,
yeah, we also
Space.
Did, yeah, we also did Willy's Wonderland on the Rage for Cage show.
Yeah, I love that movie. I fucking love it.
I wasn't crazy about it, but it was hardly it's not as if I didn't get what was on the tin, as they say.
Yeah, it was, you know what I mean? You know, we're not going to go in depth about that in the manner that if we were reviewing it in the manner that we've gone about Mandy, you know, it's on a very different it lives on a different shelf, for lack of a better word. But, you know, for what it is, you know, I just think it's just fun as fuck in my mind. And, you know, like I say, when you come to animatronic horror in, you know, arcade style places, if I had the choice between Willy's Wonderland and Five Nights at Freddy's, I would definitely pick Willy's Wonderland.
Well, I guess I did too, because I still haven't seen Five Nights at Freddy's, and I just don't think it's going to happen at this point.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where you're like, oh, I'll see it when it comes out, and then it gets a little bit down the line, and you're like, I've still not seen it, and then you're like, I can't be arsed.
Yeah, like, I have more of a fire under my ass to see Thanksgiving, because I still haven't seen that, and I genuinely feel like I missed the boat. Like, you know, I heard a lot of, it was a lot of fun, I really want to see that. But that's the thing about Mandy. I mean, I saw it on Shudder last night to kind of, you know, review and refresh. I know it was done on The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs, and I know that increased viewership and interest because so many horror fans who just don't see and hear about everything get introduced to new movies that way. This movie is, it's going to be around, you know what I mean? This movie has staying power.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. And you know, for as much as, you know, we talk about this sort of golden age that we're going through right now, you know, there's still, it's the same with any other era of horror, there's still only going to be a certain amount of movies that make it to that echelon of, you know, people are going to remember this movie in 10, 15, 20, 30 years time. You know, you go back and you think about those movies from the 70s and the 80s, you know, people remember your, People remember Alien. People remember Halloween. People remember Elm Street and Hellraiser. And these are the movies that had staying power. And, you know, these are the movies that are so fucking memorable. You know, that's a very limited list. There are more, but there's a ton of really fantastic movies that came out at the same time that we all love that didn't have that staying power. And I think Mandy is definitely going to be one of those ones that flies under the radar for another few years. But I think, you know, in 10 years' time, we're going to be, you know, let's remember a cult classic.
Yeah, the people that love it, I think, are going to continue to love it. They're going to continue to spread the gospel of Mandy. And one day enough people will have heard from the children of the new Mandy. And and we'll have enough followers singing its praises. I've got some friends on another podcast, Liam and Wayne, on the In Film We Trust podcast. And they like to say that they like to quote some filmmaker who is famous for saying, there's no such thing as a bad movie. There's only 30 years.
And, you know, he has a point, though, because there's, you know, the time can do anything to the biggest, you know, the biggest successes can be, you know, dismissed so easily in just a few years. But some of the biggest failures can become so beloved, you know, years down the line. And, you know, I once again refer to, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing, which is a movie I will absolutely... a movie hill that I will absolutely die on. Just to keep us rolling here. So it's funny because you mentioned this earlier in the episode. So I always enjoy it when people pick up on the trivia for behind things as well. So there are several similarities between Jeremiah Sand and real life cult leader Charles Manson. Like Sand, Manson was a failed musician who reportedly took it very personally when his musicianship was insulted. Sand reversed to his victims as pigs, as did Manson and his followers. And psychedelic drugs were also a big feature used before acts of violence as well. So as we were talking about there during the main piece of the episode, you know, lots of similarities there. So clearly, you know, some sort of influence was taken there as well. So really interesting as well. There's a scene earlier in the movie when Red and Mandy are watching on their television. The movie they're watching is Night Beast from 1982. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah, I picked up on it, but only because it was pointed out to me by somebody else. You know what I mean?
I hadn't noticed it in like the first.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know Night Beast.
I noticed it in the first few viewings, and then I watched it on like the fourth or fifth time I watched it, and I was like, that looks familiar, but I couldn't quite place it. And so I went to go look it up and I was like, oh, that's fucking Night Beast. Yeah, of course it is. The chainsaw fight, the big infamous chainsaw fight, it had to be filmed. It was filmed in one night of shooting. They filmed the entire scene in one evening. The director, Panos Cosmatos, went on record to say it was absolutely hellish to shoot that scene. It was just like a living hell because it was such a long night of shooting to get all the shots correctly and to make sure, like, continuity wise it was all, you know, above board. Apparently it was just the worst scene in the movie to film, so, but it was worth it for us because I fucking love that scene.
Oh yeah, well, one guy who is incredibly dedicated is this writer director. I mean, he worked on the script for like 6 years before they were even able to get moving. It was on the strength of his previous film, Beyond the Black Rainbow. Elijah Wood got so excited about that movie, he got involved.
Yeah.
Hey, what's your next thing? And that's what led to Mandy being a reality. So again, as we often end up doing on my show when we're talking about new horror, we got to give it up to Elijah Wood. Thank you.
Yeah, I think Thank Elijah you. Wood is someone at the minute who is so underrated in terms of their importance to horror right now, because, you know, everyone, like, and again, this is not to diminish these people and what they're doing as well, but everyone, you know, is talking about your Jenna Ortegas and your Mia Goths and, you know, your Robert Eggers and all these people and your Jordan Peele's and what they're doing with horror. Elijah Wood, his record and his filmography within horror, and not just, you know, in front of the camera, but behind the camera and producing roles as well, you know, he's becoming such an important player within horror. And, you know, he's someone else who's delivered some really fucking incredible performances. You know, you talked about Maniac earlier, you know, the performance that he gives us in Maniac and in things like Come to Daddy as well. And, you know, as someone who I think is, you know, is massively underrated in terms of the performances that he gives.
Has he ever been nominated for the Horror Hall of Fame over at Pod of the Damned? Because I think he really should be a contender at some point.
And this is one of the reasons why I say I think he's really underrated, because he's not, obviously, you know how that works. Me and Nico both pick someone and then we open it up to everyone else to vote. And I don't think he's ever actually made the shortlist from the public vote. Maybe someone for me and Nico to think about for next year. You know, we've got a big illustrious list of people in there now. You know, we're up to double figures in our Hall of Fame now, and you know, there's big blockbuster names like John Carpenter and Vincent Price and Stephen King, and you know, and Elvira's in there, and Sigourney Weaver, and we've got Barbara Crampton. So I think maybe Elijah Wood's definitely a name I think is fast becoming up there with some of those names.
And had you read in your research that when they first approached Nicolas Cage, they wanted him to play Jeremiah?
Yes, I did read that. And I was very intrigued by that, because I then tried to sort of picture what that movie would look like. And I think Nicolas Cage is someone who is perfectly capable of portraying that role in the manner that he did. But I just think there's something about the way Linus Roach looks. There's something about the way he looks that I'm not sure Nicolas Cage would have been able to sort of, there's just like sleazy about him. And for as much as Nicolas Cage can do a lot, he never ever really strikes me as someone who's overtly sleazy as a character.
Especially for how long we have seen him in movies, his relationship to the public, he is kind of like a kind, stern stepdad, weird uncle. He's like a weird mix between Liam Neeson and John Candy. He's just not villain material anymore, unless the project is really campy and theatrical and comic booky. And we, the audience, are like, oh, look at him go. He's such a good bad guy. This needed to be menacing and insidious, and I think it was absolutely the right choice for him to be Red and for Linus Roach to be Jeremiah.
And this is not me saying that I wish there was a recasting done, because as we've said already, Linus Roach does a fucking incredible job. But you know who could have done the role of Jeremiah Sand and been the sleazy, creepy person that we want them to be? Elijah Wood.
That's true.
You know, just
and it's neat too, because the original idea and the reason he wanted Jeremiah to be an older actor and he was wanted Red to be a younger actor is the original idea with the script was for the main conflict to be old versus young. But then once they kind of got past that and allowed Nicolas Cage to be Red, it kind of infused all the adjustments that they did moving forward. And I think it triggered a change for the better. I do think Elijah Wood would have been creepy and insidious. I think he could have done the sort of Paul Dano thing where he's like eerily calm way too often, you know what I mean? Whereas Linus Roach kind of always felt like he was on the edge. Even when he was talking softly, he looked like he was just seconds away from flipping out.
Yeah, no, 100%. Okay, just a couple of quick more pieces for me. And then if you've got anything else you want to add, we can add, and then we'll move on. Nicolas Cage had an uncredited screaming coach for this movie, who was named David Sellers. So he actually had someone to coach him specifically through that scene on how to scream, which is, you know, something that I don't think I'd ever really heard of before.
Oh, yeah. No, you know what? Here's just real quick tidbit. I was trained as an actor many years ago, and we had a special workshop on what was called vocal violence. And it was taught by this actor who sort of was teaching you how to scream in a very violent, you know, frightening manner, but in a way that does not shred your vocal cords. Because as an actor, whether on the stage or on screen, you need to do it over and over and over again. And it needs to be as full as it can be every time, but you need to not shred your throat. So it's something, it's like vocal violence, I think they call it. And it's a thing that actors absolutely have to sometimes train in.
Yeah, I think that's an incredible little aspect, you know, because again, there's the performance that he gave in that one specific scene we've talked about. Obviously, Nicolas Cage, you know, makes multiple noises and screams throughout this entire movie, but you know, we talk about that one particular scene in the bathroom, going back to it, and it's so incredible. The final piece of trivia that I've got, so there is a reference to a very famous 80s slasher series in this. There's a scene with Mandy and Red where Mandy says in a scene that she and Red lives near Crystal Lake, which is of course infamous among horror for being where Jason Voorhees and Mrs. Voorhees killed the victims in Friday the 13th. And going on and so forth. So I thought that was like, I always love, you know, little Easter eggs like that, where we talk about, you know, some of our favorite horror movies, and we you know, I almost love like the tiny ones that you miss as well. You know, I rewatched Scream not long ago, and obviously, you know, a big portion of that second half of the movie has the fucking Halloween theme tune going on in the background, and half of that movie going on in the background. And whilst I fucking love it, I almost love these much more tiny Easter eggs where someone's just like, oh yeah, I live up near Crystal Lake, and never mentioned again.
Yeah. And it's insane too, because Panos Cosmatos is like such a huge fan of metal and horror and cinema. Apparently, the movie is so dense with references that it's like if you took a drink every time you came across one, you'd be on the floor before Mandy was in the bag.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, so I don't know the band Celtic Frost, but they're like this kind of this fucking, you know, heavy group. And yeah, the shape of the axe, that fucking blade, is the Celtic Frost symbol. It's, you know, the other really interesting one that I appreciate. I'm gonna give you two. Lizzie the tiger is named Lizzie because originally in the script Lizzie was a lizard.
Yeah,
that's like correct. A little lizard. And I think it was on the day of shooting that they learned, oh hey, quick change, Lizzie's a tiger now. Okay, let's all get ready, action. And I can't remember who it was, if it was Nick Cage or Richard Brake, talked about this in an interview, and it was just like, okay, we're doing this. And my only other little thing, because in addition to being a horror fan, I'm also a Batman fan. I've got a sub-series on my show, I Am Batman, where we look at a different Batman property. And I appreciate Batman connections. And yes, friends, there is a Batman connection, because Linus Roach plays Bruce Wayne's Papa Bear, who gets shot and killed in Batman Begins. And Richard Brake is the guy that shoots him.
Yes. So I read that. And I couldn't believe it. Like, when I read it, I was like, how the fuck did I miss that completely? I completely missed that reference. And I was like, how the fuck did I miss that? Because, you know, I'm a big Batman fan as well. I especially love, you know, Batman Begins and Dark Knight. Those are two of my favorite, you know, Batman properties. And I couldn't believe I missed it. But yes, I love it, love it, love it. Also, just a quick tidbit on the side there. So, obviously, Lizzie the Tiger, now that you've brought the tiger up, that was actually one of Carol Baskin's tigers from Big Cat Rescue. I wasn't sure if you were aware of that.
I was not aware of that. Oh, goodness gracious.
So that bitch Carol Baskin had her hands all over this movie.
Never mind. I hate this movie. Fuck this. Why, how dare you even bring me on to talk about it?
One day I may do a Tiger King side series. No, I don't think I could put anyone through that.
That's a Patreon exclusive if ever I heard one.
Oh, no, don't tempt me. Don't tempt me. Okay, with that being said, we shall move on to our final segment of the show, and we'll talk about our ratings and our reviews.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
And as always, we will start off with the critics' scores. IMDb have this movie rated at a 6.5 out of 10. Metacritic have it at an 8.2. The Rotten Tomatoes critics. Now, I was really surprised by this because, you know, this felt to me like the sort of movie that would be much more loved by the audience than it would by the critics. Because you know what the critics are like when it comes to, especially when it comes to these kind of movies that are so based in, you know, cinematography and visuals and things like that. But the Rotten Tomatoes critics have this at 91% fresh, whereas the Rotten Tomatoes audience has it at 67%, which is still a fresh score. But 91% for the critics, I thought was massive. Their consensus: Mandy's gonzo violence is fueled by a gripping performance by Nicolas Cage and anchored with palpable emotion conveyed between his volcanic outbursts, which I think is a very poetic way of describing this movie. As always, we throw it out to our followers and listeners, asking for your scores and opinions. I won't read your one out because you still gave us one, but I won't read it out because I'll give you the opportunity to say your own piece. But well, here's just a few of them.
That was so stupid.
Crow Studios gives it an 8 cheddar goblins out of 10. Said the most batshit 80s movie that never was. Horror Through Her Eyes podcast: I haven't watched this since it came out, but at the time I rated it a 7.5 out of 10. Definitely due for a rewatch. Josh from Munch My Benson and SVU podcast says anyone who doesn't say at least a 10 is wrong and should have to face off against a black skull. 100 out of 10, best film ever, is what Josh says. Sarah NSMTG gives it an 8 out of 10. It's my kind of weird. That's all she could say. And then Poppy gives it a 7 out of 10, saying, I liked it much more than I expected. So that's just a little sample of what some of the people had to say. I think everyone there, much more on the positive. Took everyone's scores together. The listeners, on average, gave this movie a 7.5 out of 10. Which for me is a really great score. Again, this is one of those kind of movies that I think it would have been a really easy one for a lot of people to give it a lower score because of, you know, it's the fact that it's based so much on visuals and symbolism. And, you know, for a lot of people, I think they will label this sort of artsy kind of a label at them. You know, it's like the people who, you know, use the term elevated horror for anything that's released by A24, you know. So that's that. 7.5 out of 10. So that just leaves me and yourself. So Jeff, on a scale of 0 to 10, what would you rate Mandy and why?
10 out of 10. I think this is a film that takes advantage of all the ways in which cinema as an art form can convey mood and story and tone. I think it's a feast for the eyes as well as a symphony for the ears. I think the performances are the absolute perfect amount of exaggerated to both be larger than life and make us feel grounded in the established reality. I think the movie does a particularly effective job of taking us on the journey that it's going to take us on, whether we want it to or not, and that there's something very powerful in a piece of cinema that can do that. And at the time, this was something I was so hungry for, and I didn't even realize it. 10 out of 10. It's long, it's slow in parts, and yet it's never boring, and I always am ready for a rewatch. Mandy, 10 out of 10.
I can't argue too much with that. As I'm sure you're familiar, I've never rated a movie 10 out of 10 in this podcast, and I fully intend to stick to that. I'm never, ever going to rate a movie 10 out of 10 on this podcast because I just genuinely don't believe there's such a thing as perfection out there. You know, I'm quite the cynic when it comes to these sorts of things. However, Mandy, it's a movie that I think possibly comes closer to achieving what it wanted to achieve than any other movie out there. You know, they clearly set out with a vision. It's something that took a number of years for that vision to become realized. You know, you already mentioned that, you know, the director was poring over this script for a number of years before it finally went into production. You know, they had issues around who was playing what characters and you know, trying to get Nick Cage on board and things like that. But the final result we got through all those years of hard work and dedication and then the filming, which obviously it was potentially a bit of a slog to film, which, you know, we maybe already alluded to. But I think just on pure fact that this movie is so, so layered, you know, when it comes to reviewing movies, and I don't know if you feel like this sometimes as well, you know, when you're looking at a topic that you're coming to review for an episode, sometimes it's maybe a little difficult to come up with, you know, these are all the points that I want to make in order to make like a decent sort of length episode, an episode that people are going to be interested in and, you know, want to hear us speak and talk about. You know, sometimes that's not easy for us guys as podcasters, as people to do. Mandy's just been such an easy, this has possibly been one of the easiest sort of episodes for me to record in terms of, because there's just so much to talk about and it's so in depth, and we could literally cherry pick every single scene from this movie and probably spend 20 minutes to half an hour just discussing that one scene. You know, we probably could go and talk about this movie. You know, we've done an hour and a half already, and we probably could go and talk for 3, 4, 5 hours about this and completely break down every single fucking aspect of it, because there's just so much there. So for that reason, and then, you know, comparing it to some of the other movies and my enjoyment level, I'm going to give Mandy a 9 out of 10. It's right fucking up there near the top for me. Like, it's such a good movie. It's a movie that I've only ever enjoyed more and more with every single watch as well. Every single time I watch it, I see something else that I maybe didn't see before. Every single time I watch it, I maybe come up with a slightly different theory for who this person is, or what their motivations are, or what the aftermath of something is. And I think for me, you know, when we're talking about movies that have such huge longevity and movies that will be in 10 to 15 years, the movies that we talk about, that's the sort of thing that's going to make Mandy one of those.
Yeah, I, like you, often for a long time was very averse to giving anything a 10 out of 10, right? And then, and I can't remember if it was your show, because I can't be pressed to know which episode this started, but it felt like you were doing episodes on movies that I was like, well, fuck, that's a 10 out of 10. How can you say Jaws isn't a 10 out of 10? And like, I kept having to say movies were 10 out of 10, and I just couldn't bring myself to not. And then I finally was like, you know what? There's just a lot of really kick-ass movies out there. And like, you know, my rating system is very subjective. It has so much to do with what I feel the goal of the movie was, the budget, therefore the possibility of the movie, and then what they accomplished, and also just how it felt, how I felt. And then on revisiting, like, it's so subjective, but yeah, I never used to think, oh no, 10 out of 10, very rare. And you have really proven me wrong just in the last handful of episodes you've done, because I found myself rating things 10 out of 10 way more than I expected to.
Yeah, I think in like the last sort of few months of episodes, you know, we've covered, you know, obviously we're doing Mandy today, but we've covered Aliens, we've covered Jaws, we've covered The Thing, we've covered, you know, these are all the sorts of movies that we've been covering.
Yeah, man, are you kidding? These are 10, 10, 10, 10. How do you do this to me?
And, you know, and I've not rated a single fucking one of them. And you know, to much to Nico's annoyance, because I think he really, you know, he really hates it as well when, you know, I don't rate something either on the point or on a half point. So it either has to be, say, at 9 or a 9.5, for example. So, you know, sometimes though, you know, when things I just think maybe just aren't as, I just maybe don't enjoy something quite as much. I mean, when we covered Halloween, which again, as everyone knows, is my favorite movie of all time, it's the movie I think comes closest to perfection. I can't rate it a 10 because I don't think it is absolute perfection. So I gave it a 9.8 at the time. And Nico was so pissed. He was so fucking pissed at me. He was not happy. And I've done that now maybe like 3 or 4 times. I did it on a couple of episodes ago for Aliens, where I gave it a 9.4, and I gave The Thing a 9.7. So, you know, I'm really just doing it to piss him off. I think I did it with like my Hellraiser episode as well, where I gave it like a 9.3, just to annoy him. But no,
I can understand the mathematical benefit of getting a little granular with it, because you are making a leaderboard.
Yeah.
And so the notion of certain movies being a little weighted, I think, does carry a bit more weight.
Yeah.
But also, bonus, it annoys Nico.
Yeah, exactly. That's a bonus. when I guest on other people's shows, I'll throw out tens on other shows. You know, I think when it comes to other shows, you know, I'm coming at it from a much more personal standpoint. Whereas when we're doing this show, I feel like I'm more analyzing it for the masses. So when I go onto another show, this time suddenly becomes just about a movie. So there's movies that we've reviewed on this show I think Candyman, sorry, for example, I give a 9.5 on this show. A while ago, I was on the House That Screams podcast covering the same movie, and I gave it a 10. You know, I've thrown out quite a few 10s on that movie, because then that's then coming from my own place of pure personal enjoyment, you know. So that's where it comes. That's how it kind of works for me. Whereas Nico, I think, you know, when he's on the show, he does it more from a place of personal enjoyment. He's thrown out a few 10s. You know, he gave 10s to The Thing and Aliens and... Yeah. The Omen, and he gave a 10 to Prey as well, which, you know, I think is a massive, and The Lost Boys, of course, which is his favorite movie of all time. I think it would be he keeps getting very upset because I keep omitting, you know, The Lost Boys from any sorts of conversations, from being like the best movies we've ever reviewed. For as much as I love The Lost Boys, you know, it's just not the best movie ever made, is it, Nico? So
I mean, yeah, I'm also that circus freak that prefers Near Dark to that. I think it's kind of it's more like a dirty Western, and I like that. And so, yeah, just throw that one out there. I think if I did my top five vampire movies of all time, I don't think Lost Boys would make it into my personal top five.
Oh, Nico's gonna be very upset. I don't.
I'm not even making that up.
Awesome. Well, I'd just like to throw it out there as well, because Nico, obviously, although he can't be here today, he's been under the weather and he's, you know, got work commitments, unfortunately couldn't make it today. He is not as big a fan of this as we are. He still likes this movie, he says, but he gave it a 6.5. So he's more in line with some of those sort of critic scores. So it's still not a terrible rating, but, you know, not as high on it as some of we are. So given all of those scores, mine's and yourselves and Nico's and the audience and the critics, Mandy gets an average score of 7.9 out of 10. And it makes it into 22nd place of the now 95 movies we have covered on the show. And it is sandwiched directly between American Psycho and the original Candyman.
Respectable.
That's very respectable company. And it's funny because one further place above it is Near Dark.
How about that?
So there's always these little twists. This is one of the things I love doing, and one of the reasons why I have a leaderboard, because all of these little twists, all of these little freakish things always end up happening. There's always something. Yeah, you mentioned Near Dark, you know, completely unprompted. There it is. This movie we've just covered is just two places and 0.1 points behind it. So, but you know, like the company this movie is in, you know, some of the movies around it, if you go just a few places higher up, you've got things like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Descent, and Prey. A few places below, you've got things like They Live, Trick or Treat, Evil Dead Rise. So, you know, this movie is definitely in with some really great fucking films there.
Yes, good company indeed. Those are all great flicks.
Yes, indeed. Well, with that being said, it is time for us to bring this episode to a close. We've gone about 40 minutes longer than an average episode, so thank you so much for having such an incredible discussion with me, Jeff. Once again, before you go, would you just like to remind people about Movies for Days, what you're working on, your network, everything to do with yourself?
Yeah, thank you again for having me. Movies for Days, your non-pretentious, easy access movie chat podcast. We do a deep dive into a different movie every week, and variety is the spice of life at the network. You never know what we're going to be covering from one day to the next, whether it's a classic corner with mom, where we talk with my actual mom, Tarantino Jamborino, I Am Batman, the Rex Brothers, where me and my actual brother kind of talk about a movie that one of us recommended to the other. Nah, it's fucking Movies for Days at my network, and I'm a proud member of the You Run Podcast Network. Check them out at YouRunPodcast.com. You can check me out at Movies Days. Days is spelled with a Z. That's on Twitter, on the Slasher app, at Movies for Days. It's the same damn thing, but there's a four right in the middle. Thanks so much for having me on, man. You can be checking out my current episode on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You can check out next week's episode on The Shed. You can check out last week's episode on Mortal Kombat 1995. We're having a lot of fun at my fucking network, and I hope you are too. And I always have a good time here talking with Ian, Pod of the Damned. Dude, thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
No problem at all. Thank you so much again for coming on. If you would like to follow this show across our social media platforms, we're on X at Damned Podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Pod of the Damned. You can email us at podofthedamned@gmail.com, and you can subscribe to us on Patreon, patreon.com/podofthedamned. You know, check out the episodes that we've just released in the last couple of weeks. A couple of weeks ago, you know, Nico was on his last episode, we covered one of the greatest sequels of all time in Aliens. Last week, we had Ren from the Horror Flicks and Guitar Picks podcast on the show to talk about The Black Phone, which was another really fucking fantastic discussion. Check out this episode. Check out next week's episode, because Nico is back! Finally, again, you know, he's taken a couple of weeks off. He's had his man flu and his work commitments, but he'll be back next week, and we're talking about Army of the Dead. I think that's going to be a very different type of discussion to what we've had here today. Nico will be back.
I offered some thoughts on that one.
Definitely.
On that little chestnut.
And I'll definitely be reading those out. Stay tuned though for future episodes as well, because we've got a number of other guests coming on. The wonderful Candy from the House That Screams podcast, who's been on a guest on this show many, many, many times, will be back on the show in the next few weeks. We've got the wonderful people from the Dissect That Film podcast who will be joining us as well in the next few weeks. So please stay tuned for those guys. We've got some other wonderful guests lined up for the first part of this year as well. So I just want to say now, thank you once again to you, Jeff, for coming on to the show. Thank you to everyone for downloading and listening to this episode. And until next week on the Pod of the Damned, just remember, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. Thank you.